Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most of the ice in the world is found in the Antarctic. When a chunk the size of Delaware, one of the biggest on record, breaks away, that's news. Sometime between July 10th and 12th, a 1-trillion-ton iceberg calved from the Larsen Sea Ice Shelf in Antarctica. The event was not a surprise, and scientists say that because it was already floating, the breakaway won't have an immediate impact on sea levels. Today, we're talking about what led to the calving and what it portends. Joining us is science and environmental journalist Douglas Fox. His two-part special report on Antarctica, published in National Geographic, is available. You can check it out on the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, Douglas Fox.
Good morning.
Also with me here from the Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State University, glaciologist Ian Howitt. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Ian, what's the difference between an ice shelf and a glacier and everything in between? What does it mean?
Well, a glacier we typically think about is on the bed. So it's ice that's thick enough so that it's grounded on the bed. Whereas an ice shelf is floating.
On the bed of the continent.
On the rock.
Gotcha.
Sitting on rock. An ice shelf is floating. An ice shelf is attached to the glacier, and the ice in the ice shelf used to be on the continent on the bedrock. And you can think of the ice sheet or the glacier as pancake batter kind of spreading out on the pan. And when it gets to the edge where the ocean is, since the ice is less dense, it floats. And so it lifts off the bed and forms an ice shelf, which is kind of the last rim of ice around the ice sheet itself.
We've described this new iceberg as the size of the state of Delaware. What's the size of the ice sheet that it broke away from?
So the Antarctic ice sheet in total is huge. It's the size, about the size of the continental United States, the contiguous United States plus Mexico. It's about twice the size of Australia. So it's a huge area. The ice shelf we're talking about is called the Larsen Sea Ice Shelf. There's A, B, and C, and actually D, which are all form this ice shelf complex. And the Larsen Sea Ice Shelf is about half the size of Ohio. And so this iceberg that just formed, about the size of Delaware, is about 13-14% of the Larsen Sea Ice Shelf, which is a very small part of the continent of Antarctica. So in terms of relative sizes, we're dealing with a huge amount of ice, but in Antarctic scales, a tiny amount of ice.
Are all icebergs former parts of ice shelves?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And a lot of the questions for a lot of lay people out there immediately after this occurred was, oh, are the oceans going to, oh, I mean, this is so big. Is this unprecedented or it's one of the biggest in recorded history? What's the displacement going to be when it comes to water? But because it was floating, it was already displacing.
That's right. It's just like an ice cube in your glass. So as the ice cube melts, the water level in your glass doesn't go up because the ice is already displacing its volume. It's the Archimedes principle. So it's already given its mass to the ocean. But the problem is, the reason we worry about ice shelves is that you can think of them like a dam holding the ice back. So the ice is flowing down towards the ocean. The ice shelf rubs against the walls that it's flowing out of, so either the margin of the ice or the mountains that it's flowing out of. And the ice shelf generates enough force to hold the ice back to an extent. So when you take the ice shelf away, it's a little bit like opening up the floodgate on a dam and letting the ice flow out faster.
So when it's flowing out from the glacier, that can displace.
Yes. So once we start taking ice from the continent itself, from the ice that's grounded, sitting on bedrock, that hasn't yet given its volume to the ocean yet. So you're basically taking that volume of ice, melting it, and dumping it into the ocean, which is... It is different because it hasn't, it's not in the ocean yet. So the ice shelf, on the other hand, is already floating. So it's already, that mass has already been given to the ocean.
Is there any significance as far as this size goes? Does that tell us anything new because it was so big? Or is it just the, you know, that's the breaks?
It it does give us a window into the, how these big events happen. So these, the bigger the event, the less frequent they are, just like earthquakes or big floods. We don't have a lot of them. And we've only been able to see these kinds of things for 20 years or so. Our satellite record, satellite remote sensing from space is the only way we can observe this. And we've only had satellites that can see this for a few decades. So we don't see these events very often. Now, it's not unprecedented. A iceberg about twice this size broke off from another ice shelf in 2000. We didn't have as great observations then, and people didn't care as much then. Mm-hmm. So now we have a lot more data. We can observe how these breaks happen, and we can do a better job in terms of figuring out how stable the ice shelf is going forward.
Douglas Fox, just as a journalist, first of all, what's your sense about how this was covered? What, you know, what journalists glommed onto when it came to this calving and Larsen C?
Well, I think there's a tendency in the press generally that, you know, every few years that there is a calving of a major iceberg, and I think it's often treated, you know, as being, you know, a particularly significant event in terms of climate or something. And really, you know, I think as Ian was saying, a huge iceberg like this really does, pardon my language, it really does kind of represent sort of the normal bowel movements of a healthy ice shelf. These things, you know, it calves off every 5 or 10 or 15, 20 years, and then it moves, and then the ice shelf moves out and calves off again. So that in itself is not significant. But I think, you know, the context here, where it's happening on the peninsula, that we've actually seen a number of ice shelves already collapse, 4 of them down the peninsula collapse. I think the media has been a lot more, I think the media has been less just sensationalistic, for sure, on just glamming onto the fact that it's a big iceberg, mm-hmm. and a little bit more aware of, yes, well, it's hard to attribute a single event to climate change, that is, this single calving, it's very hard to attribute that or not, that certainly in the context of what's happening in the peninsula, it does matter.
Is the size of it a function, Ian, of how the ice shelf was formed at the time? It was in such a way, and that happened a long time ago, right?
Yes, the ice shelf itself has been there since at least the last ice age. And the ice, as it's coming off this part of Antarctica, which is very mountainous, by the way, this is the part of Antarctica where if you took a cruise ship, you'd go and look at huge mountains with orcas porpoising out of the water and all that wonderful stuff. So it's a very rugged place. And so the glaciers spill off the mountains directly into the ocean and kind of merge together. So you can think of it like rivers meeting at tributaries, as tributaries and forming trunks. And they merge together and then spill out across the surface of the ocean as ice shelves. And so you have this shelf, this platform of ice filling this embayment, and each one of these glaciers feeding in a section of it. And the area where this crack that formed this iceberg started is already really fractured. It's a place where the ice shelf kind of rubs up against a island. And so that creates stresses that break the ice and cause cracking. Now, usually those cracks propagate into the ice shelf a bit and then stop at a place where the ice is a little soft. It's mm-hmm. called a suture zone. And so it bends instead of breaks. For whatever reason, now and again, the crack makes it through that soft ice into the open expanse of the ice shelf, of the ice shelf proper. And once that happens, there's really nothing to stop it. And so the size of the iceberg that results is a function of where that crack forms that makes it through that soft ice barrier into the ice plane. And in this case, it was at a point where it created a large iceberg. There's been, this has happened before, smaller icebergs in this area have been formed. I think the last one was in the mid-1980s, and there was one in the 70s. So it's been a while. So we were kind of due from mm-hmm. that perspective. And as Douglas just mentioned, this is, I liked his analogy of the bowel movement of mm-hmm. the ice sheet. This is how the ice sheet in Antarctica loses its, it kind of balances its mass. So if it wasn't for calving, it's so cold in Antarctica, there's very little melt. So if it wasn't for calving, the ice sheet would just keep growing and growing and eventually bump into Australia and Africa. So we have to have calving. It's a natural thing. It's just a question of how quickly it happens.
And Douglas Fox, you wrote about this. I mean, this was predicted. This is not a, for the rest of us, for the little people out there, it's a surprise. Wow. But for those of you who cover it, for those of you who study it, it's not a surprise. You wrote about it a few years ago, right?
That's right. So the Antarctic Peninsula, and this is just for telling people the geographic layout, this is kind of the tentacle of land that reaches up toward the very bottom of South America. So it kind of gets into some of the northernmost parts of Antarctica. The Antarctic Peninsula is one of the fastest warming places on the planet, particularly on the west side. It is warming atmospheric temperatures 3 to 5 times faster than the rest of the globe. And as these warmer temperatures sort of push further south along the peninsula, there has been a series of ice shelf collapses in the last, I want to say, 30 years, starting with Larsen Inlet in about 1989, Prince Gustav Ice Shelf and Larsen A Ice Shelf in 1993 to 1995, and then Larsen B in 2002. And, you know, each time this has happened, it's followed kind of a, at least in the cases where we were able to watch in advance, particularly for Larsen B, it's followed kind of a similar script where, you know, there were a series of calvings of icebergs and the years leading up to the collapse, which, you know, I would say were fairly conventional in the way that this Larsen C calving is relatively conventional. And then at some point, over literally a period, during a hot summer, over literally a period of about 30 days, it goes from this regular regime of just every once in a while calving huge icebergs to just kind of shattering almost like a windshield into these hundreds or even thousands of, almost call them shards, these long, skinny Tetris piece icebergs, a totally different shape and size of iceberg than normally occurs. And that it, you know, literally happens, this can be seen from satellite images, it literally happens, big changes even over periods of hours. And then these things roll over in the ocean and drift away. So it happens all at once. So we've seen this. We've seen this before.
And what happens, what do you expect to happen to the new iceberg now? How, because it's so big, will it take longer to break up? How will that happen, Douglas?
Right. So, ironically, although the Antarctic Peninsula is such a rapidly warming area, on the east side of the peninsula, the Weddell Sea is some of the coldest water on Earth. And that water is actually circulating from down south, the Weddell Gyre, big current pushing it. And this iceberg will probably last for years. You know, how many years, I can't tell you, but I can say that in 2010, when I was on an icebreaker on the Antarctic Peninsula, you know, at one point I looked up, you know, from the deck, and I counted something like 54 icebergs around us, most of them these big, flat, tabular ones. And some of those were from the Larsen B collapse from 8 years before. Things melt very slowly in this area. There is a lot of sea ice, by which I mean not glacial ice, but this ice that's just a few feet thick, that is frozen seawater, you know, seasonal sea ice, that probably slows the movement of the icebergs as well. So it'll hang out there for a long time, you know, in that area. It won't have any importance or impact for the ice shelf or the glaciers behind it. As far as they're concerned, it's gone. But, you know, at some point, this berg or the pieces of it will drift further north, north of the tip of the peninsula, and then it hits warmer water and it can be gone in months.
Hmm. Even something that big.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it varies with the size, but, yeah. but they can, once they get further north, they can disappear quite quickly. And this has actually been documented, putting sort of sensor stations with cameras and tilt sensors and melt sensors on icebergs and kind of watching them, you know, sort of phoning home every day with new photos, and then suddenly, boom, it's gone.
We're talking about the significance of this very large calving from the ice shelf, one of the ice shelves off the Antarctica, the continent of Antarctica. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Douglas Fox. He's a science and environmental journalist and the author of a two-part National Geographic series entitled Crisis on the Ice. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also with us, Ian Howitt. He's a glaciologist from the Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State University. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the breakoff of the Larsen C ice shelf in the Antarctic and the implications at that continent's, you know, implications for that continent's landscape in terms of breaking or melting away. Still with us is science and environmental journalist Douglas Fox. His two-part special report on Antarctica, published in National Geographic, is available now. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also from the Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State University, glaciologist Ian Howitt. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Douglas Fox, I wanted to go back to the issue that you were raising earlier, and of course, Ian Howitt, chime in. You said that the Antarctic Peninsula, the continent, is the fastest warming on Earth. Why is it warming so quickly?
Right. Well, there's probably a complicated version of that answer and a simple version. I mean, I think the simple way of saying it is, you know, you look at our planet and it's taking in most of its warmth from the sun in the tropical regions. And whenever you're heating, you know, you can imagine if you just have a 12-foot-long pizza that's stuck into an oven and most of the pizza is actually sticking out of the oven. Whenever you're heating something in one place, the tendency is for things to kind of reach an equilibrium and for heat to kind of migrate into areas that are not as warm. And so, you know, you have, in the case of the pizza, you know, you may have parts of it that are not in the oven, but they will also, the heat will kind of conduct through the pizza and you'll melt cheese even mm-hmm. further out. I haven't tested this, I have to admit.
You're making me hungry now.
With the 12-foot pizza, yeah. But in the case of the Earth, this is happening through, especially through ocean currents. And you've got waters that are picking up significant amounts of heat in the tropical parts of especially the Atlantic, but also the Pacific. And then they are sinking down into the deep oceans where they're isolated from the rest of the world and carrying that heat over periods of years underneath the Arctic and then down underneath the Pacific and later on actually reemerging to shallow depths and kind of heaving kind of big plumes of this water over the lip of the continental shelf of Antarctica. And there's also involvement of air currents too, but so much of the heat that is reaching the Antarctic Peninsula, even the warm air, is a result of this warm water upwelling.
So it's heating up faster because there's because it was colder to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I think
it's a relative thing, then?
Yeah, well, it's just kind of the details are complicated, but it is simple physics that when you when you're heating one part of something, but not all of it, there is a tendency for the excess heat to be redistributed into colder areas. I mean, these areas aren't suddenly hotter than, you know, than the tropics. They're still a lot colder,
right,
but they are heating, they are warming up more quickly.
And is this part of, Ian Howitt, what you're talking about when you're talking about the change of the continent and how quickly the glaciers are melting, or is that different?
Well, there's a few different things going on. And I think first, we need to put the context of where Antarctica is and why Antarctica is Antarctica. Antarctica is unique because, well, first of all, it's land at the poles, unlike the Arctic, which is ocean at the poles. Mm-hmm. And the ocean can freely circulate around Antarctica like a spinning wheel. And it forms this current called the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which just goes round and round clockwise around the continent. And this current forms effectively a barrier. It's like a wall, a climatological wall that keeps heat out and keeps cold in. So it literally treats Antarctica like a freezer. And the Antarctic Peninsula is the place where that current narrows to just kind of squeeze through in between the Antarctic Peninsula and South America, the Tierra del Fuego. That's the Drake's Passage, the famous Cape Horn, where the worst place to sail in the world. And that's because you have the Pacific frantically trying to get into the Atlantic there. And so it's just a climatologically and oceanographically very vigorous place. And the warming, the extreme warming there is partly a result of that. It's very teleconnected. So anything that goes on, as Douglas was saying, anything that goes on in the globe somewhere else is going to be felt there and amplified by all of this heat and energy going through this passage. The rest of Antarctica also feels this barrier of the circum-Antarctic current. But the barrier gets weaker and stronger with time, kind of like these pulses. One example of this was recently there was a lot of melt where there usually isn't in places in Antarctica that are usually very cold. And that's because during an El Nino like we just had, a strong El Nino, that barrier caused by the circum-Antarctic current and the westerly winds that go with it kind of weakened a bit. And that allowed the warm air from the tropics to make its way down to Antarctica as part of the El Niño. So that was an example of how this system of Antarctica can vary. And the same thing's going on in the ocean. So if we look at other places along the continent that are retreating and thinning quickly at their ice margins, it's because warm, very warm, deep water, it's salty, so it's dense, so it stays at the bottom, has been making it increasingly closer to the Antarctic continent itself and kind of spilling into the edges of where the glaciers are, where the ice shelves are, and doing a lot of melting. And so in most places in the Arctic, in Antarctica where we see the ice shelves responding, it's because this deep, warm, salty water is making it to the ice, the underbelly of the ice, and melting it from below. So it's not directly an atmosphere forcing. It's the ocean doing the work.
And there's nothing humans can do. This is way out of our, you know, ken at this point.
The problem with the oceans is they're even more complicated than the atmosphere in a lot of ways. And we also have very little data. The Southern Ocean is probably the least explored Earth system left. We have this vast amount of ocean with only a few measurements. And because of all of this, these teleconnections I'm talking about, it's a little bit like the kid's toy where you have the wheels with the cogs and you spin one cog and it spins another cog.
Yeah.
And spins. So you can have something like winds changing in the tropics. That acts to spin a cog that spins another cog in the ocean. And eventually those cogs lead to the forcing that we see in Antarctica. So it's a very complicated system. And we don't yet have the ability to predict how those cogs turn. We don't really know exactly going forward how warming is going to affect things like coastal circulation along the Antarctic Current. One thing we do know is that nearly all of the extra heat that the Earth's absorbed over the past 50 years, 50 to 100 years, due to global warming, anthropogenic climate change, has gone straight into the ocean. It's about 94% or
so. So these are the changes in the atmosphere that allow the
That's
Earth
right.
to absorb more heat.
But the atmosphere can't hold very much heat. It's not. It's a very thin little blanket.
Mm-hmm.
The ocean, on the other hand, which is filled with water, which has a huge heat capacity, can absorb a tremendous amount of heat. So that extra heat that the atmosphere is absorbing goes into the ocean. And the ocean itself has absorbed enough extra heat to melt the equivalent of about a meter and a half of sea level rise in ice. So we've already stored enough heat in the ocean that if that heat makes it to the ice sheet and melts it, it would give us a meter and a half to 2 meters of sea level already. And so the big question for us Earth scientists and using every discipline that we have is figuring out how quickly that heat can get to the ice sheet. That's the big question.
And Douglas Fox, what does your reporting tell us about the human contribution to all of this? I mean, humans are one of the cogs in this machine that Ian Howitt just described, right?
Right. Yeah, of course. I mean, I think this is probably the best. You know, the best people will find reasons if they want to, if they need to find reasons to criticize all kinds of things like the temperature, you know, the thermometer temperature record and that kind of thing. This is the best kind of evidence there is of anthropogenic climate change. I mean, you may be able to argue about whether 40 years ago at a certain place where there's a thermometer, whether it was 2 degrees warmer or cooler. On the other hand, you can stand on one of these fjords of a glacier where there used to be an ice shelf. As I've done, I've stood on the fjord of Sjogren Glacier on the Northern Peninsula, and you can see the scars left on the landscape. You know, it's almost like a scab has been ripped off, and you can actually see kind of the bathroom rings around the lower slopes of these mountains where the rock is light colored. It has only been recently exposed to the atmosphere, and so it still hasn't weathered. You can see the outlines of the glaciers. But I also wanted to, I also wanted to talk a little bit about just the impact of these ice shelf collapses when they have happened. And this kind of fits into the category of, can humans stop it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's easy to kind of gloss over that, saying you'll lose more ice when the ice shelf collapses. So we've lost 4 ice shelves on the peninsula so far. And every single glacier that has had an ice shelf behind it that disappeared has literally accelerated its flow into the ocean by anywhere from 2 to 9-fold. You know, these aren't just partial accelerations of 10-20%. This is accelerations up to 200-900% their original speed. And, you know, if you think about when Larsen B ice shelf collapsed in 2002, there are instruments around the peninsula where they actually measure tiny changes in the rising or falling of the Earth's crust. And so great was the weight of ice removed from this area, glacial ice that poured out after the ice shelf disappeared. So great was that removal of weight that the Earth's crust literally sprang up like the cushion of a bed. For example, when you lift a heavy box off of the bed, the rate of lifting of the crust tripled within months. And there are some places now that they've placed instruments closer to where Larsen B was, there are some places where the ground is literally rising about an inch per year, pretty close to an inch per year. And it's because all of this ice is removing, it has been removed and continues to flow off every single year. So this is a small part of Antarctica. The stakes are small compared to other places, but these are huge changes.
When that land lifts up, like you described, like a mattress. Is that affecting water levels? Is that affecting sea levels? What does that affect?
Well, I think probably there are some subtle longer term effects there, and maybe Ian could speak to that. But I think the main reason that I mentioned that is simply that is simply to point out what a big change this is. You know, you're not only, I mean, the crust is, I don't know, anywhere from 30 to 50 miles thick, something like that. You know, this is rock. It takes a lot to get rock, to get 30 to 50 miles of rock to spring up. I do think, you know, there's certainly as things like ice, you know, are removed from one place or another, you get some places where the land goes up and other places where maybe it goes down a little. And I think the other big sort of issue is that you change the gravitational field of the Earth so that, you know, if you raise sea level, say, an average of like 3 feet, a meter, that's not going to be 3 feet everywhere. That's going to be 4.5 feet in some places, and, you know, maybe 1.5 feet in other places, depending on where the ice melted from.
It's possible. I wanted to talk a little bit about what you guys do. I mean, Douglas Fox, you just described where you were. You were there. You saw that. Ian Howitt, what is it like to do what you do, to study this kind of stuff? When you go up there, what's it like? Do you go up there in the summer of Antarctica?
Well, yeah. Generally, except for a few people, scientists only go to Antarctica during the Antarctic summer, so the wintertime here. And actually, it's warmer in a lot of these places in Antarctica in the summertime there than it is in the wintertime here in Columbus. So it's actually a little tropical vacation.
Yeah,
no.
Okay.
really the on-the-ground science gets done only in the summer season in Antarctica. And that it's mostly due to logistics. There's been times where some of the few winter over staff, these are people that keep the bases running, the skeleton crews that kind of do the base observations from the stations, where they've become sick, needed evacuation. And that becomes a major epic in itself, getting people off the ice sheet. So it's very it's discouraged to do anything on the ice sheet during the winter time. Same is true for the Greenland ice sheet. Mm-hmm. Very little gets done there in the winter. And these places, especially Antarctica, this is a place that up until a few generations ago was the equivalent of space travel. So, before the 1960s, really before World War II, going to these places was saying goodbye to your family for years, getting on a boat and being gone with it, no contact. There's very little infrastructure. I mean, we're talking about a continent the size of twice of Australia with maybe a few thousand people on it. During the summer. And so it's a very challenging place to work. It's a very expensive place to work. And when we talk about the limits of our understanding of Antarctica, unfortunately, it comes down to money. The amount we know is directly dependent on the amount of observations we can get, and that's dependent on how much we can spend to do it. Of course, a lot of our work now is done from space. So satellites are essential. If it wasn't for the satellites, we would know very, very little about what's actually going on in Antarctica, including this iceberg.
And Douglas Fox, before I let you go, it's possible that fewer climate researchers from the United States, at least, will be heading out into the field over the next few years. President Trump has proposed his proposed budget for the next fiscal year includes pretty steep cuts to environment and science budgets, and that affects all of this, right?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of ways you have to study Antarctica to kind of have good coverage of the place. And the satellite monitoring is, you know, irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that happens 24/7 year round, even when no one's within hundreds of miles or even thousands of miles of an area. But, I also want to say there is a lot of important work that really can only be done there. In some of the cases, in the cases of these major outlet glaciers that really do have a lot of sea level rise potential on the main part of the continent, you got to monitor them from space, but you can't stop there. In order to really know what's going to happen, you actually have to map the bed of every single one. You have to map how far it drops below sea level. Does it drop 4,000, 5,000 feet or more below sea level? Because that tells you about the ocean water, the warm, deep currents getting in. That involves setting off seismic charges. It involves ice penetrating radar from an airplane. It involves measuring changes in the gravity field. And literally sending things underneath the ice shelf sometimes, you know, robotic submarines, in order to measure the water currents directly. So it really is, it really does involve exploring the continent and you know, kind of in each of these places.
Douglas Fox, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Douglas Fox is a science and environmental journalist, and he's written a two-part series for National Geographic. It's entitled Crisis on the Ice. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Antarctic region is home to nearly 10,000 species, but rapidly melting glaciers and ice sheets have threatened the plants and animals that live there. That impacts Antarctica's ecosystem, which in turn affects the rest of the world. Climate change and human interference is one facet of the problem, and scientists are already looking to the future to find ways to preserve biodiversity before it vanishes. Still with us from the Bird Polar and Climate Research Center at OSU, glaciologist Ian Howitt. Thanks again, Ian, for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is staff scientist at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute, Pierre Comazzoli. Pierre, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And director of Antarctic Ocean Protection and the Global Penguin Conservation Campaign at Pew Charitable Trusts, Andrea Cavanaugh. Welcome, Andrea.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Andrea, what impact does the Larsen C shelf breakoff have on Antarctica's ecosystems?
I think that's a great question, Anne, and it's something that the multilateral body CAMELAR that regulates the water around Antarctica did something just last year to try to make sure that they can find out the answer to that. Last year, they decided that anytime an iceberg calves off in Antarctica, they would close that area for a period of 10 years so that only scientists could go in and study what happens in the ecosystem when the iceberg calves off. And so that happened just last year, and it's a great step forward. It's one of the, I think, the biggest step that CAMELAR has taken to study the effects of climate change. I think they've been a little bit slower than they could have been on this issue. So we were really happy to see that happen last year.
Pierre, you work largely with fertility preservation. The Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington maintains the world's largest collection of frozen exotic animal milk from mammals large and small. When did this issue of preservation start to come to the forefront for scientists, and what does it have to do with Antarctica?
Well, I think it's really important to always keep in mind that we need to preserve biodiversity whenever we can. There is nothing, of course, there are really impressive events like what happens now in Antarctica or with the loss of tropical forest. But the most important is really to know, to be kind of a proactive and to really document and preserve as much as we can of what we have on the planet right now. And there are multiple ways to do that, including actually building frozen biomaterial collections for studies, but also to maintain populations in the wild as well as in zoos.
You know, we were talking, Ian Howitt, earlier about the cost to study Antarctica. And I'm wondering, you know, we hear about the samples that are taken, the ice samples that are taken. How, I mean, how do you preserve all of that over time? Is that preserved in perpetuity or what?
Well, they're archived at in giant freezers, basically. We have one here at at Ohio State at the Bird Center that houses an inventory of ice cores. And so these are at great expense brought back. The ones that are collected by the United States are brought back to the United States, kept places like here and also in Denver, Colorado. There's another big facility. And they're kept in perpetuity as long as we can keep the freezers on, but they're there for people to study. One thing that happens is that new technologies come online for analyzing these ice samples that when the ice core was collected, they didn't exist. They brought it back, and then this new technology came online, and because the ice core still exists, they can go and use this new technology to get a new record of, for example, metals or some other material in the ice core.
Pierre Comazzoli, you know, there's so much, there's so little land that's in Antarctica that's just land that animals and flora exist on. How much has actually been lost? What do we know about how much is there?
Well, you know, what's really interesting and fascinating with Antarctica is that it's always considered as a really, of course, it's an inhospitable region. It's really cold and biodiversity is maybe less, you know, impressive than in tropical region. But some studies have shown, for example, that the soil biodiversity is really rich in Antarctica. And it's a really good example, actually, for other ecosystems in the world, because the biodiversity in the soils really condition the biodiversity that you have at the surface of the planet. So I think it's really interesting that we have this example of model of Antarctica as a model for other ecosystems.
Andrea Kavanaugh, has anything been lost yet that's of significance that anyone, any, you know, everyday people could relate to?
I think what has been lost is mostly around the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the fastest warming part of the planet. It's also where, though, the krill fishery is heavily concentrated. So there are populations of penguins there that are experiencing crashes, the chinstraps and the Adelie penguins in particular. And those are the most krill-dependent penguins. And it's hard to tell right now if it's a climate problem or if it's a fishing problem or if it's a combination of the two. And so we've been working to try to get this area closed to fishing so that scientists will be able to just look at the effects of what's going on with the long-term climate changes there and not have the fishing coming in as an added factor. This just this year, Chile and Argentina have been working on a proposal to create a large marine reserve around the Antarctic Peninsula. And they've been working on it for years with a number of countries and scientists from all over the world who've been putting data into this process. And we're really looking forward to this year seeing the proposal come to Camloar and see exactly what they hope to close down. And these sorts of things, these large-scale marine reserves, are what the Pew Charitable Trust has been working towards in Antarctica to try to preserve ecosystems and the interconnected processes of the ecosystems, and also, of course, the individual species like the penguins.
Why is it hard to know why the krill population is shrinking?
Because there are a lot of different factors happening. So, first of all, the krill fishery is something that's happened since the 1980s.
So it's relatively new.
Yeah, it's relatively new, but even more recent, though, it's become, it used to be spread out all along the entire Southern Ocean, so surrounding the continent of Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, it's become very, very, very concentrated in local areas on the Antarctic Peninsula. So in the Bransfield Strait, in the Gerlach Strait, which is where they're very narrow areas of the peninsula that have huge biodiversity, you know, killer whales and penguins and you know, humpback whales and seals and just, you know, huge amounts of life that depend on the krill in that area. And so the krill fishery has concentrated a lot over the years in just over this last decade in those areas. But it's, like I said, it's also the fastest warming place on the planet, and krill depend on sea ice, which is the ice that forms and breaks up every year, or actually the multi-year sea ice that stays a little bit longer. And they feed on algae that's underneath that ice, as well as use it as protection from predators and things like that. So that sea ice is disappearing. So that's part of the habitat for the krill is disappearing. The waters are getting warmer, so there's also some evidence that it could be acidifying, which would be causing problems with krill, because krill are a tiny shrimp-like creature. And so as the waters acidify, their shells start to dissolve. So there are a lot of different factors that are happening there, and it's really hard for it to be teased out of exactly what the problem is. I mean, clearly there are multiple things happening with krill that are then affecting other animals in the ecosystem.
And Pierre Comazzoli, I wanted to go back to something that we were talking about regarding the collection of frozen exotic animal milk and from mammals. There are also banks of animal DNA. And I'm wondering, is the idea to actually preserve the DNA for the future when those animals cease to exist? Or what's the purpose of that?
Yes, and actually, you mentioned the milk bank that we have at the National Zoo, but this is just a small fraction of the frozen collection that we have at the whole Smithsonian, because as you just pointed out, we have also DNA samples. But better than that, we also preserve sperm, oocytes, gonadal tissues from our live cells from a lot of different species. And we use those biomaterials not only to study, to understand the DNA sequences and to relate species to each other, but also we actively use those collections of biomaterials to make babies, to recreate babies. And one of the best examples that we have is one of the recent clouded leopard cub that was born at the Columbus Zoo, and he was born after artificial insemination with frozen sperm.
Okay. The impact of climate change on the native wildlife. I'm interested, Ian Howitt, and from what I know, native wildlife isn't what you study, but do you notice any differences?
In Antarctica, no. I wouldn't. I look from very high in space usually.
Right.
I know that there are changes. Penguins are especially impacted by these kinds of events, iceberg calving events, because it changes where they can exist
right.
and live on the coast. In the Arctic, there's clear changes about where, for example, where polar bears are hunting. Changes in the sea ice location, you have animals that are critically dependent on the edge of the sea ice. So if you have less extensive sea ice, they have a narrower range, and that directly impacts them.
Okay. Ian Howitt, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Ian Howitt, glaciologist from the Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State University, and also Pierre Comazzoli, staff scientist at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And Andrea Cavanaugh, director of the Antarctic Ocean Protection and the Global Penguin Conservation Campaign at Pew Charitable Trust. Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.